We're going to check in a little here about just a summary for a second about these screens and our electronic devices. And I was saying last week that I didn't appreciate that I could even practice with these things because I didn't think Buddha talked about screens. You know, I think these electronics that we use, they do something to us. They are otherworldly, you could think of it that way. Way I've heard people talking about it, it's like, and I've seen it in myself, you're in another world. You're in the world of that screen. So it's not like, I don't believe that it's not intimate. It is intimate. You know, when we're watching a movie, especially just imagine the good movies you've seen. It's intimate. Documentaries you've seen. You know, all kinds of movies that move us in some way. I remember when you guys know I went to see Hamilton, and then of course I got obsessed with it. They couldn't even barely give my Dhamma talk one Tuesday because I was so obsessed with Hamilton. And when Hamilton came out on Disney Plus, I thought, it's not gonna be the same. But of course, you know, that opening weekend, I was going to watch Hamilton. So I did. I loved it. I had the same intimacy watching it on TV as I did when I saw it in person. So it can't be the screen itself. There's something that draws us in on these screens, and we need to pay attention to that as practitioners. Not the good side or the bad side, but the drawing in and how it draws us in. Draws us in so much so that we don't see or connect with the other world. So it's like we're drawn in to the screen and we have to leave the outer world. And you know, I like that the discussion nights are summaries, but I don't like that it should be just the same old from last week. So I started thinking about this drawing in. And the thing that I realize, there's two things that the Buddha pointed to that really helps us with screens. The first thing is relationship. That's what we talked about last week, how Buddha was with relationship, and he took relationship very seriously. Even as lay practitioners, he was very clear about paying attention to your relationships and who you're hanging out with. Now, you might not have any screens they didn't have screens in Buddha's time, but they hung out with each other. And who you're hanging out with has a lot to do with how you're willing to stay on the path. Because we are social beings as human beings, and we mirror our behavior to other people. And so Buddha's constant pointing towards being with a wise beings and beings that the wise would not repose became important because that's who you're going to start mirroring your behavior to. Not only that, people are mirroring their behavior to you. And so the more you stay on the path, the more you line up everybody else. So there's this way in which I think there's a sutta that I think really points to what it is I'm talking about. The Buddha gave this sutta about some acrobats. You may have heard this. So there's a young acrobat who's a new apprentice just learning out, but he's really strong and he's really capable of doing some of the moves in a very, you know, I mean, he's just great. He's good. He's young. He's visceral. He can do it. He got heaviness and arm strength, and he can do whatever acrobats do. He can do it. And then there's this older acrobat who's wiser, but he doesn't have the ability that he used to have in his younger years. So they do a little bit of routines together, and the older, more wiser acrobat realizes, hey, man, this guy is so good that if he pays attention to my energy, and if he watches me, and he learns from me, and he looks after me, we are going to really be good together. I won't mess up so much, basically. That's what he tells the younger acrobat. You're really strong. You're really good. You look after me, and we're going to be really, really good together. And the younger acrobat says, no, I think I look after me. You look after you, and we'll do really good together. And what the younger acrobat was saying is, basically, you know your own limits and you watch your own behavior. Don't put the responsibility on me. But if you tighten up your behavior and I tighten up my behavior, we're really going to do good together, as long as we pay attention to each other. And the Buddha asked the practitioners that were with him, which one did they think was the best of the two? I don't know what the monk said, but Buddha said it was the younger of the two. And that's what he's saying. In a relationship, we each have our own responsibility to carry our own behavior. So if we're not paying attention to the beings we're living our lives around, intimate with, connected to, associated with, then we don't pay attention to the effects that those beings are having on us in our own practice. I remember when I worked, you know, I was a prosecutor, so lawyers don't meditate. At least they didn't in the, you know, 90s, early 2000s when I first started practicing. I started practicing in the mid-90s, and yeah, lawyers didn't meditate. So I had to go to the bathroom, to use the bathroom as my meditation periods. I couldn't practice more than a couple of minutes anyway, so it didn't really matter. It was good for me. Everything's good. That's about as long as I could stay still. But I noticed that if there was a kind of energy with my cohorts, the first time I really noticed it, the best way I can explain it was in the lunchroom. So in the lunchroom, we would get together at lunchtime. In the mornings, you got all your trial calendars, and you're working with defense attorneys trying to figure out who's going to trial, who's not going to trial, what cases are doing what. But at lunchtime, we would get together and we would talk about the judges, the defense attorneys, just gossiping about the whole system. And, you know, it was fun. I got to tell you, it was fun. It was laughter. We were loud. You're shaking off all that fear and nervousness about what's going to happen with your cases, and you're letting go of a lot of steam, and it's really, 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 really supportive. But it just so happened at one point, Rodney was talking about the Eightfold Path, and he started talking about the precepts and right speech. And I remember sitting in there one day, kind of listening, hearing how we were laughing and talking about people. And I got this feeling in me that said, this is not right speech. There's something wrong. But I was torn because it felt like I was coming up against this kind of, you guys are bad and I'm good. And I don't want to be with you because you guys are bad. And I couldn't bring myself. I think I set out one of the lunches that like the next lunch or something like that. And I was so lonely. I could hear him laughing in there. My whole mind was over there in the lunchroom. I didn't want to be. It's sort of like this line. I was like, how do I be with them and not cause harm? It was one of the first times I brought my practice into the office, because I go back in the room. I started sitting with them. But if they started saying something that was harmful, I stopped talking. I stopped talking and I stopped laughing. And I didn't say anything to them. But people began to say, uh-oh, I think we've upset the Buddhist in the room. Somehow we've gone too far. Pull it back a little bit, you guys. I mean, there was a way in which energetically I begin to line them up too, that we all begin to line each other up. And it's not like we didn't laugh and make a whole bunch of noise, but some of the aggression in which we would put people down began to filter through this kind of energetic flowing, connecting, lining up, realigning, without me having to put someone down. Just begin to show up. This is what I think the Buddha was pointing to in relationship, and I think we are having relationships with these TV shows, these social media, with the screens that we're looking at. We are having relationship, and that's what we have to begin to acknowledge to ourselves, so that we are in relationship at the way we want to be in relationship. But the thing that I've noticed this week, that I didn't talk about last week, but I'm really beginning to see, is how much we, whether we practice internally and externally with what it is that we're engaged with. Because the Buddha, in his establishing of mindfulness, it wasn't just telling you, you got to be mindful. And in a way, that's the way we kind of talk about it. I got to learn how to be mindful. I got to be mindful. I want to be more mindful. As if we can just be mindful. But what he actually said was that a person would begin to pay attention. You got this ardent kind of upright energy, and you pay attention internally and externally and both. So sometimes we get so pulled into the screen that we are completely external. And sometimes we get so pulled into our phones that we are so internal. And so the question is, can you be both internal and external and both as you're doing these screens? Can you pay attention to what's happening outside of you, aware of it? Don't have to be engaged with it, but can you pay attention to what's happening outside of you as you are paying attention to what's happening inside? Or if you find yourself more outside, can you pay attention to the internal going on with you to help you stay more grounded in these screens? It was the internal external that helped me with right speech around my job. And it's not that I didn't participate in wrong speech, because sometimes other people in the room had to adjust our behavior, because I would be so caught up in my case and the person I'm talking about that I would miss the external. I was disconnected with the internal, and I'm too external trying to explain my situation. But my friends would begin to notice, and they could help me pay attention to the internal signs that are saying, I don't know if you want to talk like that. I don't know if you want to say it quite like that. See what I'm saying? So this internal, external relationship, the way we can connect all this is through the hindrances. Because the hindrances help us experience energy in a way that it blocks us or doesn't block us. So there's a way that the hindrances actually help us sense into energetic flows. And that's what we're looking for. It's how the hindrances, so like if your hindrance that you're in stuck in all the time is like aversion, let's say, you find yourself stuck in aversion a lot, then you might want to notice how that aversion shows up with screens. Does it show up often or not often? Can you see the aversion in the screens? Or maybe your hindrance is desire. You're always wanting, wanting, wanting. And then you might notice when you're on the screen, when you decide that you need some downtime, you're looking at things you can buy. Maybe you buy it, maybe you don't. But that wanting, desire, desire, desire is energetic flowing in the world. You know, and artificial intelligence, those ads are going to pop up constantly until you buy the thing. It's just going to keep coming around, keep coming around, keep coming around, trying to convince you that all we need to do is do this 15, 16, 17 more times, and then you're going to buy it. So you're watching the desiring mind, the wanting mind, the unwanting mind. You're watching when you're using screens because you're bored in sloth and torpor and you're just using the screens to just buy time. Or maybe you're restless. I noticed that my play solitaire is when I'm restless and I need to concentrate the mind. And it always started out, like I said last week, it started out great. That it was a concentration of the mind and it would settle me into this restlessness so I wouldn't fight it so much. But I would keep playing past the settling of the restlessness and just play for hours. And eventually I had to learn how to manage that so it's not just about me playing for hours, biding time. That's what the doubt, I think, also is that we can get caught up in Dhamma doubt. But I think the Dhamma doubt is probably the least practiced thing, but it's so important. We get into wanting to increase our practice, so we think we're not good enough right now. And we begin to find ways to practice, find things to practice with. I need to do this. I need to do that. And people will read books constantly. They will listen to Dhamma talks constantly. They will be on the internet, and I'm guilty of this, searching for Dhamma information and just reading the suttas, just reading, reading, reading. And I do believe there's some wholesomeness to this. But if your searching is because you don't think your practice is good enough, now we're getting into doubt and we're trying to find a solution to make our practice better. And if you're sitting on this call, you don't need to make your practice better. Your practice already is working on it. It's already in the mix. It's just figuring out on its own how it's going to come out. And we don't have any, it's like Philip says, if you ask Philip about, well, you know, I'm trying to do this on my practice, he'll say, that's none of your business. Your practice is none of your business. I like that. Because really, your practice isn't yours. It's your subjective world is bringing the practice into its own world, its own understanding. So I thought tonight we would talk a little bit about how we are with these screens. How are we You can talk about it from the framework of the relationships you have with these screens. You could talk about it from the framework of, am I drawn more internal or external? That kind of, do I close off the world? Like if I watch a good movie, you might as well not even, I don't even care if people walk through, could be a fire down the way. Is there a way I could take this TV with me so I can keep watching the show, or I'll just get up later. Hopefully the fire won't come into my place. I just get so drawn into it. I have a hard time pulling away or listening to anyone. So when my kids were little, this is probably terrible, but when my kids were little, I trained them that we could only talk and jump around when the commercials came on. So if you were to come by my house, you'd see them sitting there quietly watching the movie. And then as soon as a commercial would come on, they are jumping crazy loud all over the place. And then, whoop, very quiet during the movie. But, you know, it worked for me. I was happy with it. But now it's like the same way my oldest boy's wife says, what did you do to him? It's like he acts crazy. As soon as a commercial comes on, he's driving me crazy. I'm like, well, you gotta watch Netflix and you don't have to worry about the commercials anymore. Anyway, the point that I'm making is you can look at it from the hindrances. You could look at it from internal, external. You could look at it from how you are in relationship. The only requirement that I'm going to bring here, we can get serious in the next couple of weeks, but this right here today, I want you to think about the things that make you laugh about it. The things that you're like, oh, I cannot believe I do this, or this kind of way that I am. Keep it as humorous and as light as you can. Not serious kind of punishing yourself, judging yourself, comparing yourself. All right? It's got to be joyous or you won't look at it. It's got to be humorous or you'll just build up another layer of what's wrong with me. And that story has played itself out. So, but if it's humorous and if you're listening to other people, then you can all begin to see, oh, this is so human. This is the way we are. And there's nothing to be upset about. So the last little thing I'm going to leave you with, I don't know if I've told you this. I probably have because I think it's the cutest thing I ever read. But His Holiness, you know, the 14th Dalai Lama, did a conference in California. They were doing their compassion work. And I can't remember. I think he was in San Francisco. Anyway, his hotel was straight down the street to the conference center. And every day for, I think he was there for a week, and every day for a week, he would drive by this row of all these electronic things. And he would look at them outside of his car service, the limousine. He would stare at it and stare at it, stare at it. If you don't know anything about His Holiness, he loves to tinker with electronics and take things apart and put things together. So he said in this talk he gave, that during that week of driving down to the conference center and then back and then forth and then back and then forth, by the end of the week, he wanted the drivers to stop and get him something. He didn't even know what they were, but I need to get some. I need to get one of those things because it's the pulling in of electronics. They pull us in. So the pulling in is natural. It's just that we want to see that pulling in. He could see, I want these things and I don't even know what they are. And he didn't judge himself like, oh, there's something wrong with me because I'm so pulled into it. That's why you have to have some humor in it. The pulling in is part of human existence. So I want to stop now so we have enough time to get together into groups. And anyone that wants to leave is free to leave. And the rest of us will divide up into groups here. I think it's going to be groups of four, so there's plenty of back and forth. And I'll give us a break. We'll come back in 5 minutes, and then we'll get into groups. All right? Great. Thank you so much for your practice. So if we're ready, I got the rooms all split up. 4 people in each one. Take some time. You're not really judging each other. You're giving each other an opportunity to actually have some humor about hindrances, energy flow, relationships. And I'm going to give you plenty of time to talk about it. We're not going to come back till 8:30. And so there should be at least 5 minutes each that you can talk about it. All right? All right, so I'll open all the rooms up. I see some smiling faces. That's a good sign. Got some teeth showing. That's a good sign. That's a good sign. Good. Well, let's see if anybody would like to share how this was. You know, some of the laughter that comes with seeing this humanness about us. Allow people to unmute themselves. You can raise your hand with the raise hand button, or you're all fit on my screen, so I can see you if you raise your hand up to the camera. Wait a minute, you're not going to share with me? Okay, good, David. Thank you. I get to share in the laughter, too?
Yeah, that's right.
That's right. I need some mudita.
Let's get some mudita going. You know, what was funny, at first, I was thinking about some things that were like 10 years old. Just some weird rabbit holes I went down, you know, like with the online forums and like research and stuff. And then we started talking, and I realized that I've been like really sucked into this sleep app where it like tracks like in really close detail, like how I'm sleeping and stuff, but it doesn't actually provide me with any like actionable insight. So I do all these things to try and maximize my score. So like when I wake up, even if I've been awake, like I move around really quietly and stuff, just so I can have like a good score, you know, like I want to have a good score.
That is right.
And I don't want it to interrupt. I don't want any like gaps in my week. And it's just absurd. Yeah.
Yes. And you know, it's you're having a relationship with this app,
yeah,
as if it's another person, but it's not. It doesn't, that app does not care how you sleep. It doesn't have any iota to it, but yet we relate to it like it's another being. Like, yeah, I'm having a relationship with it. So, mm-hmm, you're really judging yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a kind of a judgment that you're putting on yourself that's unnecessary because no one else even sees it, let alone cares about it.
Yeah, it's nuts. And there's countless examples of that, but yeah.
I know. This is what we do. But this is the nature of the human mind. We start having relationships with these screens as if they're, you know, have you ever cussed out the automatic caller when you call into something and you're all upset and you're snapping at the automatic caller and then it's not even a person, it's just a computer.
Yeah, you know, I'm embarrassed to say, but I will, that I have lost it so thoroughly that they actually put me into like a different category. Like they bypassed like a whole bunch of stuff. They're like, I think he needs a person.
Me too.
Oh man.
Someone taught me, I think my sister, I think Janice, when she was working at this call center, she said that if you talk gibberish and the machines don't understand it, then they'll just send you to a person. So I just started talking all this gibberish stuff that doesn't make any sense and it doesn't understand. They're like, hold on, let me get you somebody.
That's great.
Oh, that's great. Okay, yeah. Let's see who else.
Anyway, thank you.
Special time we have with these screens. getting a little embarrassed here. I'm not the only one having a crazy time with screens. Okay, Beth, come help me out. I see you, Katie. Good. And Bob.
Well, I have a, I confessed to my trio that my personality type is one of a wanting type, and it shows itself in my completion compulsions that have had a lot of time to fulfill themselves. And I tell people I have a PhD in Law and Order.
That's right, me too.
A master's degree in CSI.
No, me too.
I never did go to school for Criminal Minds. In fact, I turned my nose up at Criminal Minds for a long time. My mother used to watch it, and I'm like, oh, well, that's below me. Well, I lowered myself to Criminal Minds. I'm working on
that. That's right. It gets a little rough, boy, but I had to move up into the big crimes too.
Yeah, no, I'm there. And during the political hoopla that I felt equally compulsed to watch, I would find there was a salvation was found in a Law and Order SVU marathon.
Yeah.
And so I'd flip back and forth, and I found myself just so Mariska. Mariska, thank you for being there. And I told a friend, if I'm ever in a coma on my way out, put in my ear the Law and Order soundtrack to see me out.
That's right. That's great.
But I do, I do build in with my compulsions. I build in because I have guilt over it. So I tell myself I can't watch it till a certain time. I have to like clean the kitchen between episodes, things like that. So
the thing is, you're building in the external, because we get so caught in the internal,
yeah.
Caught in the show after show after show after show. So you're building in that external. That is great practice, but not out of guilt, just out of creating the possibility to be connected to the external also. It's understanding that I get really internal, I got to get some external and not guilt out of it, but just that I got to balance out this internal external. The guilt, if you do it out of guilt, the mind will just either punish you or try to get you more and more and more into the movies. So if you do it out of, like a friend of mine, I think I told you guys this, Vimala told me, just play the Dhamma talk just a little low, because I was so upset about my addiction to television. And he said, look, you don't have to stop watching TV. Just put Dhamma on just low enough that it's just, you know, it's not interrupting your show.
Eating in there. Okay.
But the mind would begin to say, oh, wait, what did he say? And then I would turn the TV down so I could hear this Dhamma. And so that's what helped me kind of get out of the attachment to the TV. It's not like I don't have it still, but I am aware now of how much it sucks up my energy. So you don't have to do it out of guilt. You have to do it out of adventure.
That makes me feel better.
Yeah, not out of guilt, because the guilt won't help you. It'll just spin you around and judge you. But just do it out of investigation and interest and get curious about it. We're all dealing with this, so there's nothing to be guilty about. Sort of like David. It's like we're having these relationships with these TVs, and it doesn't have anything to do with anybody. It's just it's not even a real being. But we just want to see. I got to remember who else. There you go, Katie. I knew somebody was like else. Yeah, Katie, go ahead.
Yeah, sure. So a bunch of us in my group have been living alone and spent a lot of time alone during this time. And I was really relieved because someone in the group mentioned how she likes to watch TV, and then she feels like she knows all the characters and like they're her friends. And I had really been feeling like that. I don't watch a lot of TV, but I'm very into podcasts. And, you know, I listen to like 10%. I feel like I'm on a first name basis with Dan Harris.
That's right.
You know me, but I feel like we're friends.
Yeah.
And I really look forward to that. But I had started to judge myself because I was like, is this getting a little weird? Like, am I spending too much time alone where I feel like these podcast hosts are friends with me? Yeah. So I was really relieved that other people in the group had the same thing, and it doesn't, I don't know, it is still like some kind of human connection, whether it's real or not. So it was,
well, you know, we are human beings, and you know about freeze, what is it, fight, flight, or freeze, right? You know about that.
Yeah.
And I learned about that when I was in psych class. What I didn't learn about, that they talk about more now, is that the reason why we have this fight, flight, or freeze capacity, or this reactivity, is because we are social beings. And that means we need to socialize. And we're always worried that we won't have friends. You won't like me. There won't be a social. We won't have a pack. We need a sangha. We need the pack. And so even if our pack is Law and Order, that's our pack. And we got to have that thing together. This is what's happening to us. So those of us that are sheltering in place, in places when we're by ourselves, we need a pack. We need a posse, a group of friends, a crew that we call our own. We need a sangha. And that's what you're experiencing. But you do know that when you can start getting out and seeing other people, when you start to choose the TV over other real people, that's when you can begin to see, am I going in here? Am I too deep in? Right? Or you could just see what happens. But don't be surprised if you tell yourself, I'm not going to watch this. I'm through. I need to give myself a break. And you feel as though you've lost your best friend. It's not a sign that there's something wrong with you. It's a sign that you are attached. And attachment is a natural part of being human. So that's where our suffering comes from, is the attachment. And as soon as you lose something you're attached to, it creates suffering. So that is inevitable. Eventually, we're going to not be connected with all these beings on TV, and we're going to have to detach ourselves from them. It won't be easy. Not for you, not for many of us. So it's just, it's the real work begins after after the pandemic. At first I thought, oh, the vaccine, finally, we're seeing some end of the road. And now they got all these reports that are like, oh, yeah, AstraZeneca, whatever that word is, it's not doing as well. Maybe we won't use that anymore. I'm like, oh, my God, we are never going to get out of this. We're just going to it's forever. It's going to be permanent. But when we begin to interact with each other more, that's when I think we're going to have to feel the pain of letting go of some of these TV characters. I've already experienced it, so I know. I know the pain of it. But it does feel like you're losing lovers, losing friends. It will have that sense of somehow I need to make time in my life so I can keep watching these shows. But luckily now they make movies, they make sitcoms that only last about a season or two or three. That's it. Anyway, I better go, Bob. And I see your hand rod in there. Go ahead, Bob.
Hi. It's nice to see everybody's faces. Our group kind of ended up talking about truth and which screen you find your truth on, and what it is that why I find it on one and my Trumpian brother finds it on another.
Yeah.
And whether it's an emotional hook or a rational one. So that was one thing. The other thing to where I'd like to hear you talk about is when I think about these screens, I think about the Buddhist idea of guarding the sense doors. And I'm wondering how you think about it. I think about doors as being, you go in or you come up, you can go in, and or stuff comes in, or you can go out through a door. And I think about what I put out on screens through the senses, through speech or hearing, as well as what's coming in. I wondered what you think about the sense doors and technology.
Well, I know that at retreats, you want to guard your sense doors because you can't get into deep samadhi if the mind is caught up in the sense doors, because you can't abandon the hindrances. The sense doors cause a lot of hindrance reactivity. I like that. I don't like that. I want that. I don't want that. And it's just, you get very reactive through the sense doors. So the more you're able to guard yourself from the sensory experience, the more you can get into deep, deep, deep concentration. So on a retreat, it makes sense. But I'm so glad that Tim, this was really Tim's idea to talk about this householder practice, because it's forced me to kind of research the householder lifestyle a lot more poignantly than I have in the past. And I think Buddha was very clear. Householders, our pleasure, our happiness, like I talked about last month, comes from sensory experience. It comes from the sense doors. So this is part of that imbalanced way of relating to Dhamma. If you're trying to live as a householder with the rules and guidelines of a retreat, because you're not on retreat. Sense doors are going to be pulled all over the place as a householder. What we're trying to balance is our relationship with these sense doors. So you're going to have sensory experience, but can you balance it? So if, when you're thinking about guarding the sense doors, it's more that I'm too caught up in the attachment around this habit energy, and I need to guard the sense door so I don't get so triggered into the habit, right? Then that is using the guarding of the sense doors in line with what I would say is a householder life. But if you're trying to guard your sense doors to the point where you're totally secluded, like on retreat, then you're not really living into the householder life that is involved with all these sensory experiences. And all these things are coming up. Like in a retreat world, you don't even know about what's going on. When we were in that March month long, we didn't even know that COVID, and it was horrible coming out of deep concentration to find out that Italy is shutting down and people can't get home and we got to let you guys go because you may not get home. And then I find out that Seattle's an epic center and I'm like, oh my God, what about Thaddeus? What about the baby? I'm all upset and worried. And then, I hate to say it, bro, when I came home, I stopped off at the store thinking that I wasn't going to be able to get any food or anything. And I got all this humongous amount of food thinking I was going to have to be in lockdown for like months. Oh my God. It didn't even dawn on me until after I dragged all that stuff home. Wait, there was like food all over the shelves. It was like, it wasn't even empty. The image they told us when we were at the retreat, I thought it was just going to be nothing. But it didn't hit me that the shelves were all full of food until after I drug all that food home. And I'm like, wait, I could have just had a couple of bags and got a couple more tomorrow. Anyway, the point I'm making is we're householders. So we're practicing within the framework of a householder. Our happiness comes from sense doors. And so if you guard it too much, you will diminish your happiness. It's not like that for monastics. Their happiness comes from the guarding of the sense doors and the abandonment of that. That's where their happiness comes. And it's because they've chosen to live a holy life that that's where their happiness is drawn into. We don't know it that way because we're not living a holy life in that way. We're not living a homeless life. We're living in sensory world. All right. So you want to keep that. Use it as a guide, but don't just throw yourself in this guilt of, I need to guard all my sense doors and cut out all these screens. Ron, you get the last kind of word here. You're muted there. I feel, Ron, you're muted. I feel like when we say you're muted, it feels like there's some kind of an illness or something. Disease, Ron, you're muted.
I just, for a long time, I didn't have a television. There was a point in my life where I just didn't need one. You know, I was busy doing other things. And so I was at work, and there's people were behind me, and they were talking. And I thought, I didn't know they had relatives, common friends, you know. And I was really confused. They went on for maybe 5 minutes, and then somebody reminded me that they had a common TV show.
That's right. I was thinking about
X-Files. I thought they were like family members.
We used to talk about Scully and what's his name? I can't think. Mulder. We used to talk about Scully and Mulder like he were our friends. What happened to him?
I was really confused, you know. Yes. I hadn't had a TV in about 3 or 4 years. So, you know, I had a couple of things. One time I went in and somebody had a TV on, and all these people they were all blue, and they had this soap all in their hair. And I'm just like, what is that?
I don't know.
It was a commercial. I mean, I didn't know it was a commercial. I thought these people were just being really crazy.
Well, I understand what you're saying, Ron, because I blame my kids for my addiction to television. I tell them that. Because I didn't have a TV for years and years and years. And Raymond sat me down. He had convinced Thaddeus to be on his side. And he sat me down to articulate that they should be able to watch cartoons on Sunday mornings. And that it was cruel for me to raise them in a world where they couldn't see cartoons on Sunday morning. Because everybody knew about the cartoons and they didn't know. They got a lot of catch up. So I went and got a TV.
Well, we had a point in our lives where one of my brothers came in and he was mad about something and he kicked the front of the TV and it quit working. And my father he didn't say much. He just said, grab the other end of the TV, and he just turned it around and faced it to the wall. And we didn't have a TV for 7 years until he won one off of some contest.
Well, this is it, you know, like there's a thing that we're going to talk a little bit about next week. We're going to talk about the precepts, because there is a relationship with screens that's quite different with the younger you are. The younger you are, the less invasive screens are. My granddaughter is 4, and she has no problems with those screens. None whatsoever. She understands them. She doesn't have to look at them. It's a very different relationship than my relationship with them. And so we're going to talk about the screens and the video games and the difference in the relationships generationally that we are. We're a sangha that has all these different layers of generations, and yet we have very different relationships with them. And we're going to talk about the precepts and how these screens fit in here in the precepts. So this is probably going to be more about the continuity of mindfulness, about how to practice within the precepts of our lives and stay connected to how we can practice with it as an object of our meditation. All right. Well, I think that's pretty much all I have. What about you guys? That's all you have?
That's it.
I think that's it then. I think we've come to the end of the road. So have a good week. Stay with those screens.
Thank you.
Watch what you're doing with them. No judgment. Laugh about it. Keep it lighthearted. And I'll see you all next Monday.
Bye.